Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, the only critically acclaimed streaming club that we have. Yeah, my name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
Not a member of the club yet, I see.
No club that would have me for a member.
Yes. My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic, and this is our streaming club. This is where we reach back into the annals of everything available on streaming, if you have the subscriptions.
Yep.
And we try to find classics that we haven't seen.
Or cult movies that we haven't seen, or weird oddities, or...
Something that... We put on the list, we're trying to catch up, essentially. We'll never catch up. No one ever will. There's too many films out there.
But Whitney and I watch a lot of movies, and we make sure that every time we put a movie on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, it's one that one or both of us have either never seen or saw, like, many decades ago and don't remember it. Mm-hmm. Every single episode of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club is curated by our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Every single one of our patrons, even for $1 a month, gets to vote on every week of the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club. Whitney picks two films that he hasn't seen from a particular streaming service. I pick two films that I haven't seen from the same streaming service. Sometimes there's overlap, sometimes there's not. And our patrons get to choose. And this week on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, we gave you a lot of options, many of which are, you know, culturally significant, critically acclaimed. Mm. Films like Bridesmaids and Flashdance.
We put
one random thing on there just because we couldn't figure out what to throw in as a fourth option.
Did you say the streaming club or the actual service that we're exploring?
Oh no, I forgot.
Yeah, we are going into Peacock.
Yeah,
which is the
NBC/Universal. Yes, it's where the Sleazaks.
The Sleestacks from Land of the Lost program, Peacock. It's the NBC/Universal streaming service that had, when they first launched, a lot of really great movies.
Yeah, Universal is a studio that dates back almost 100, maybe over 100 years ago?
Over a century by now.
Yeah, so they have a ton of films that are available to them. I'm sure some of them have their rights, like, entangled in weird ways, but they definitely have a gigantic backlog, and when Peacock first came out, quite a bit of that backlog was on here, and it was kind of cool to just see, like, all the old Universal monster movies around there, a whole lot of Hitchcock. Yeah,
most exciting were they had all of the Universal monster films, not just, like...
The famous ones.
Dracula, Frankenstein, the Wolfman. They had all the sequels as well.
Yeah, and also some of the weird esoteric ones, like Dr. X.
The Mad Ghoul, stuff like that, yeah. And then, without rhyme or reason, maybe because of those weird contractual obligations, they decided to take them all off. So when we went delving into Peacock, we're like, ooh, slim pickings.
Yeah.
But I was able to find a couple classics, which you didn't pick.
Yep, I also...
We saw... One of these films caught our eye.
One of them...
While we were browsing for something to put on our streaming club.
We were just like, let's put in one stupid straight-to-video thing that, like, everyone will acknowledge is bad and no one will vote for.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry. That one was on me.
Well,
that was on me. We ended up...
I let you do it, so this is on both of us.
Well, fair enough. But yeah, instead of talking about, for example, Bridesmaids, one of the most celebrated comedies of the last 10 years, instead of talking about Flashdance, a cultural touchstone of the 1980s, and I forget what the third one was. What was the third one? It was Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman.
Which would be a good chaser for Mystic Pizza,
which we just did last week.
Yeah, so these are all classic movies, or at the very least significant movies. And instead you picked Christmas Twister.
A tornado hit the small town of Dublin late last night.
It's almost Christmas. Tornado season's not until March.
Thanks to climate change, tornado season's coming early.
I ran all the simulations, and none of them point to an active system.
So as you can see, things should start to improve into the morning hours.
F2 in December.
F2, is that bad?
That's a fairly large storm.
Is there anything bigger, like an F6?
That's like a nuclear bomb going off.
The conditions are right for the perfect storm.
Where are you?
I just picked up Max. We're on our way to the high school now.
Dad?
Give me a minute. I'm on the phone with your mother.
Dad!
What?
Caitlin's not at school.
Yes, Christmas Twister. Who could forget that cinematic, perennial, Yuletide classic, Christmas Twister? Every year, I try to make time to watch only a handful of Christmas movies. It's a Wonderful Life, A Nightmare Before Christmas, The Shop Around the Corner, Christmas in Connecticut, and of course, Christmas Twister.
Christmas Twister is about a twister at Christmas. This is a film. I don't really need to say this part, but it stars Casper Van Dien.
Because of course it does.
Because of course it does. Yeah. And I was also surprised to see that it has Haley Lou Richardson in it. Young rising actress. She was in Edge of 17. She was in Split. She's been a lot of things recently.
Yeah, so she worked her way up a bit.
Yeah, so yeah. This was something. This was a film that came out in 2012. It was a straight-to-video thing. It was directed by a guy named Jack Sullivan, who has...
Peter Sullivan.
Peter Sullivan. I apologize.
How you did that. But yeah, Peter Sullivan has a long pedigree of producing and directing, mostly straight-to-TV type movies. He did a lot of... one second. I got his producing credits, and they're huge.
He did a lot of Christmas movies and a lot of, like, thrillers for Netflix in recent years. Mm-hmm. Like, Fatal Affair came out last year, which I almost reviewed for KCRW, I think.
Oh, weird.
Like, it was in the conversation, but we didn't end up doing it. But yeah. Some of the Christmas movies, Christmas Edition.
Yeah.
The Road Home for Christmas. Mm-hmm. Jingle Bell, B-E-L-L-E. Mm-hmm. My Christmas Inn, not to be confused with, what was it, Christmas in Connecticut?
It was Falling In, I-N-N Love. Oh,
Falling In Love. Yeah. Sharing Christmas, Wrapped Up in Christmas.
Wrapped Up in Christmas is quite good, actually.
I knew you would have seen some of these.
Yeah. Wrapped Up in Christmas is not the one I saw. I apologize. he did Christmas Under Wraps. Similar title, which starred Candace Cameron Bure as a woman who gets out of medical school, and she had put all of her eggs in one basket. She only wanted to, have a job at this one hospital. Hmm. So when that job dried up, she had to get the only job she could get, in like the farthest northest reaches of Alaska, and it's a town where the mayor has a big white beard, and their big export is toys. And they never come right out and say it, and that's actually kind of charming. Right. It's actually kind of charming. I actually like that movie.
Remember the animated film Klaus? You know, the really good one?
Yes, that movie's great.
The Flight Before Christmas, The 12 Gifts of Christmas.
12 Gifts of Christmas, also not bad.
A Christmas Mystery.
Mm-hmm. I would just call it a Chris Mystery, but all right.
High School Possession at Christmas. No, he did a film called High School Possession, a.k.a. High School Exorcism. So he's done some, like, cheapo thrillers as well. And we were talking about this on our crossover episode with Dave White and Alonso Duralde. Mm. I was surprised that it took them as late as 2012 to make a movie called All About Christmas Eve. And if it's a riff on All About Eve, that would be perfect.
It probably wasn't.
The Dog Who Saved Halloween.
Twist. What a twist. You thought it was going to be Christmas, didn't you? You did. You were like sitting in your car. It's just like, he's about to say Christmas. I know how podcasts work. No. He said Halloween. That's a rebel dog.
The Dog Who Saved
Halloween. I wish there were as many Hallmark Halloween movies as there were Christmas movies. I feel like Halloween could be a... You can certainly at least get some fun movies out of that.
Every October, all of the stations haul out all of their old horror movies out of mothballs. Yeah. So
why not have some... Why not have, like, just a bunch of costume party rom-coms? Why not? But in any case, this is someone who works a lot. Yeah. Like, a lot in television. And the co-writer of this film, Hans Wasserberger, has worked on quite a few Christmas movies as well. He did a particularly good Alicia Witt Christmas movie called I'm Not Ready for Christmas.
Hmm.
Which was basically Liar Liar, except instead of a birthday wish, it was a Christmas wish. And now Alicia Witt can only tell the truth. Considering how wildly derivative that is, it was actually pretty cute.
There are only a few Christmas movies I really want to see, and most of them are Christmas renditions of some, like, long-running film series.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Furiously Merry.
Okay.
Or Fast and Furious, but it's a Christmas movie. Mm-hmm. I'm still waiting for Merry Crankmas. That needs to come along. That's not
like I have to get everything on my Christmas list done in one day. In order to do that, I need to keep sucking down espressos or jolting myself with Christmas lights to get the juices going.
The only thing that keeps his system working is eggnog, and he just has to keep on drinking it all day.
I want to see a Christmas version of Final Destination, but instead of killing everybody, it's Christmas Miracles. It's like some like weird Rube Goldberg sequence, and it's like one little gust of breeze knocks something over, and that sets something on fire or whatever. Like that,
but it's
and
all ominous music.
It's all ominous music, but at the end of it, Dad found a new girlfriend after Mom died. It's actually kind of nice. Come on, if there's an evil version of that, there has to be a good version to balance it out, right? It's the universe in which we live in. But anyway.
No, there also needs to be a Mary Saw-mas.
Well, yeah, that one.
A Saw movie.
That
Christmas.
One writes itself. Yeah. Because Santa's very judgmental.
Miss Salto? No, again, I can't think of a pun.
That's brutal.
I'm trying to think of a Saw pun with
that
Christmas.
That is brutal.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Ooh. Actually, I'm not sorry. I'll
Do
just
you
sell,
saw
I'll
what I saw?
One. There you go. That's a good one.
But anyway.
Just do you see what I saw? I think would be good.
But in any case, they came together, these two titans. and listen, I'm going to say this right now. We can jest. That is a long career making movies. Like, yeah. Seriously, Peter Sullivan has directed and produced more feature films that honestly probably brought a lot of people joy than, I don't know, like Denis Villeneuve. Like, he hasn't made as many movies as that, has he?
It definitely,
you gotta admire the work ethic and nothing else.
It definitely let Casper Van Dien pay his rent for a couple of months.
Right.
Casper Van Dien, I will go to bat for Casper Van Dien. I've seen him give good performances.
Sure.
I think he has talent. But I think a big issue is how he looks. He was his big breakout role, at least to my eye, was Starship Troopers.
Oh yeah, that was definitely his big breakout.
Yeah, and the joke in Starship Troopers is all of the actors were cast because they look kind of empty, and they were directed to be these sort of like empty soldiers meant to be filled with propaganda.
They're absolutely gorgeous. You definitely want to project yourselves into someone who looks like that, but in so doing, you would be unintentionally projecting yourself into fascist propaganda. That's the point of Starship Troopers.
That's the point of Starship Troopers. So,
The book was actually just military imperialism, but you know, the movie's more subversive than that.
Yeah, the movie's actually satire, but you know, he's a handsome guy. He's got a big square jaw, classic sort of like magazine model, movie star kind of looks, and I think prevented him from getting sort of a big variety of roles.
I love this. Hold on, this is amazing. I was looking at Casper Van Dien's IMDb page, and his upcoming movie. He's got a couple upcoming movies like Salvage Marines and Assailant. And he's got one coming up called Roach.
Okay, we're going to review Roach.
That sounds
when
amazing.
It comes out.
I'm on board. What a great title. Sorry.
I
just
hope it's
had
a stoner movie, too. That'd be bad. But yeah, Casper Van Dien has since just sort of worked in like TV, a lot of low budget and low profile movies, including Christmas Twister, which was, I think, retitled. I don't think it was originally intended to be a Christmas tie-in.
Uh-huh.
It just happened to take place on Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
It doesn't even take place on Christmas.
I know, it stinks. But
Casper Van Dien is, it's essentially a Twister knockoff, the 1996 film.
It's basically any disaster movie, really, where there's the protagonist is one of the people who is an expert in the disaster in question. In this case, it's Casper Van Dien. He works for a college that is studying, you know, various weather conditions because, you know, I don't know if they're in Tornado Alley, but they're near enough to it at least.
They're in Texas, and they said that March is tornado season.
Okay, so there you go.
Which is in Tornado Alley.
Okay, there you go. If you're not familiar with Tornado Alley, it's a place.
Northern Texas.
It's a place in California. It's just this big, long strip of land where they get a lot of tornadoes.
Not California, the center of the country.
Did I say California?
You said California. It's of the United States. So,
I apologize. Yeah. Yeah. I meant the country, not California. Instead of the country.
Oh, look at you, Mr. LA-centric.
I apologize. I really thought I said the word country.
There's a reason why a Twister in Kansas is a plot point in The Wizard of Oz.
Because that's
where there's, you know, because of the open plains and because of the way the wind moves through the country, there are frequently tornadoes in that part of
the country. Every part of the world has its own natural disaster. You know, California is particularly prone to earthquakes and wildfires.
We're right on a fault line.
We are.
We're going to die.
It's a stupid thing to do. And the wildfire is getting worse every single year. Yeah.
Did you hear the smoke cloud was so big it formed its own storm system?
Oh, God.
We're going to die.
Oh, that's not good. But yeah, we also have Tornado Alley, which is this huge section in California. You got me started doing that. That's your fault.
It's the United States.
Middle of the country, big section where there's a lot of tornadoes. Casper Van Dien is studying tornadoes. Basically, because of climate change, tornado season is going to be extra brutal this year, and indeed it could lead to an F6, which is basically, as Casper Van Dien describes it, like a nuclear bomb dropping on us. When you watch Christmas Twister, whether you're watching it on Peacock or It's also available on like Amazon right now, and you're going to see it look like Christmas Twister. That's what it says. Christmas Twister is Casper Van Dien's face. There's two like thumbnails, not really posters, but I don't know if there are posters, but there's thumbnails. There's one that's like this horrible disaster area. It says Christmas Twister. And then there's one that's Casper Van Dien smiling with his daughter, like, hey! And that says Christmas Twister with, like, a little doodle of a twister, like the twister is about to bring Christmas joy. It's absolutely wonderful and absurd. So you click on it, and you think you're going to see Christmas Twister, and then the movie begins, and there's this whole opening sequence that feels like a big reshoot to, like, solidify that it's Christmas, because their characters will never see again. Because there's more Christmas decorations at that opening than in the rest of the movie.
It takes place in a gas station in Texas, and they're just establishing we are in Texas.
Yeah,
it's Christmas time, and there are a bunch of tornadoes about, and it's all characters that have nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
I actually love this opening because it's filmed like a slasher movie. Like the guys,
it's dark. I think most of it's on a set, even the exteriors. Yeah.
Like the guy tells his wife and kid and daughter, like, okay, you go inside and get a slice of pie. I'll get the gas. And there's like he's getting the gas, and there's like ominous music, and it's like the camera's over here, like we're looking at him, like the twister is about to sneak up on him.
And he spins around, and there's a twister there, and it has a knife.
Might as well. Yeah. The twister like wrecks some shit, and it blows up the gas station. Oh my god!
Really bad flame effects. They had to key in like some stock flame effects. They didn't even set anything on fire.
No. I mean, granted, that's dangerous. I get it if you're on a low budget and you don't feel like you're fooling anybody anyway. Why risk it? But yeah, it never looks good. And then the credits come up and the title comes up and you're expecting to see the words Christmas Twister. And it says F6 Twister.
No, mine said Christmas Twister.
Okay, I'll be honest here. I cheated. I saw this on Amazon. I didn't have Peacock.
You saw a different cut.
I didn't have Peacock installed on my Roku.
Oh, I see.
So I have it like on my computer, but I wanted to watch it in the bedroom, so we were watching it on the Roku. And so we're like, oh, okay. I don't need to install Peacock and do the whole system. I can just watch it on Amazon. And they had the alternate title, which is always funny.
Okay, I got Christmas Twister as the actual title. But yeah, after that cold open, we meet Cass Van Dien. He works in the Twister study lab, which is somebody's office.
It's a bunch of cubicles.
It's got like cubicles and like Apple IIe's on their side to make them look like really futuristic.
My favorite bit of it is, you know, like in the cop movies when like the cops are in a car that isn't like a police cruiser, but they're about to get in a chase and they pull out that one revolving light with a magnet on it.
Oh, yeah, and they stick it on the roof of the car,
and it goes, boo, woo, woo. They have that to let them know when there's a Twister. So for some reason, that is hooked up to some computer somewhere. Whenever there's a Twister, this light kicks up on the top of their cubicle, and it's endless fun. They have a new assistant at the office. It's Christmas, which is why they're understaffed, which is as good an excuse as any to explain why you don't have a big cast.
I'm going to hire anybody else.
That's Casper Van Dien, some other guy, and I think it's like the new college intern.
Zach and I think Chloe are the characters' names.
Yeah, Chloe has to have everything explained to her, which is fine.
It's a good way to get exposition.
You need a new character
that gets the information the same way the audience does.
It's usually pretty clunky, but listen, there comes a time to be elegant about your exposition and sort of sneak it in a very organic way that you don't even realize you're getting it. And then there's also, listen, we just need to get this over with so we can get the movie going. And so she has to have the concept of tornadoes explained to her. She has to have the concept of the tornado scale explained to her, like an F0 is, it'll maybe knock over a small tree, and an F6 is, we're all doomed, we're all gonna die. And she also has to explain some really obvious things, like a CB radio. Like, I got to talk to you on the CB radio. What's that?
It's like a cell phone, just without, it's like a smartphone. It's a smartphone, but it's not smart, and it's not a phone.
So it's nothing?
It's a radio.
It's a radio.
Like, that's not so obscure a concept, right?
You could just say it's a radio. It's a radio. They used to have them in trucks more often, and sometimes they still do. Listen, why are we making this a thing? What? Yeah, I understand needing to explain the tornado scale. I understand some people might not know that. But I don't understand. Having to explain a CB radio feels a little much.
I know the tornado scale from the movie Twister, which is when they explained it. This is why I call it a Twister knockoff. And in fact, this idea of the team of experts studying a very particular disaster is a really common trope from the 90s wave of disaster movies.
Yeah, we didn't really see a lot of that in the Irwin Allen movies. I mean, yeah, I guess The Swarm, we had like Michael Caine as the like bee expert.
The one bee expert, but apart from that, there wasn't an earthquake expert in Earthquake. That's not an Irwin Allen by now, but...
There wasn't a Towering Inferno expert. Like, I wrote the book on Towering Inferno.
I know how fires work in towers. And now we have, like, Paul Giamatti appearing on the news. They're going to feel this on the West Coast.
Well, we're on the West Coast. We're on the East Coast.
Oh, that's...
You're thinking about San Andreas.
San Andreas. Yeah, I guess that takes place in San Andreas Fault, doesn't it?
I remember when the movie Twister came out, and Twister was a big movie. Like, Jan de Bont had just made Speed. Mm. Speed was a runaway hit, no pun intended. And, oh my God. That was you pretty good. That was pretty good, actually. Oh my God, I'm a genius. But Twister was a big deal. Helen Hunt was a huge star at the time, and there was CGI was starting to exponentially start affecting different movies, and a movie like Twister was something that probably would never have looked that good if it was made 10 years earlier.
It was an effects bonanza. They were testing out what they could do with certain special effects, and they all of the twisters were CG created, which was a novelty at the time, and it holds up okay. I saw it a few years ago, and it still looks fine.
There's two things I think are fascinating about the movie Twister. One is that for all the talk we have about the visual effects, which are good. It's the sound design that sells that movie. You see that movie in a theater, if you ever have the chance. You see the movie in a theater, it feels like you're right in the middle of a tornado. Like, it's really... That's what sells it. Even the visual effects had sucked, it would have been cool. The other thing I love about the movie Twister, and I love may be a strong word, but I kind of respect this. It's kind of barely a film. Like, it's not like... there's a villain, kind of, but it's just Cary Elwes, and he's just kind of, an asshole storm chaser,
He's the rival storm chaser with, like, better equipment,
but he's not
Bill Paxton is, like, the scrappy one who leads the team of misfits.
Well, Helen Hunt's leading the team of misfits. Bill Paxton was trying to leave the
team of misfits. Right,
but regardless, like, Cary Elwes doesn't get anybody killed, is my point. He's not, like, the mayor in Jaws or something.
He meets a bad end, though, because of his hubris.
Sure, he meets a bad end because someone needs to die in order to raise the stakes at the end, which is whatever. But regardless, there's not like a major conflict. They're chasing tornadoes. They try to get into the tornado so they can shove this like research equipment into the tornado. They fail a couple of times and then they succeed. There's no antagonist. There's really nothing driving it. It's kind of a mellow movie, except for all the damn twisters. And I kind of love that there's this big blockbuster that has almost no plot. And that's kind of amazing. It works because you actually like the characters. Yeah, like, chasers, like Philip Seymour Hoffman's in there. They're fun.
Philip Seymour Hoffman, in fact, plays, like, the brash fratty guy. Like, the beer-swilling drunk guy.
Which is not the type he would become known for. But it shows you how...
it's like he's flirting with women. Yeah, we go up to storms, and, right, you don't want to get in here. It's called the suck zone. Like, it says it, like, really in this seductive way. Alan Rock is in there as a character named Rabbit. And he has a line of dialogue I still quote to this day.
What's that?
Where he's like, I have all these facts. Rabbit, are you sure? Yes. Rabbit is good. Rabbit is wise. I still say that. Rabbit is good. Rabbit is wise.
I forgot about that. But yeah, it's they understand that we're here for the visual effects. We're here for the action. And we're not going to like spruce this up with a lot of unnecessary plot that's just going to get in the way of the incredible weather effect. And we just want to make sure we give a crap about these characters so we hope they don't die. That's kind of it. It's almost elegant in its simplicity. Not all the disaster movies of the time followed that mold. Dante's Peak was basically Jaws with a volcano. It's actually quite good.
It's about a volcano that swims up underneath people. And
no, it's not that. It's the premise is that this volcano is active and it's going to blow, but the town doesn't want to believe it, so they delay the evacuation until it's almost too late. So it's that element of Jaws. But it's pretty good. Volcano is rock stupid, but very fun to watch.
It's a good L.A. movie.
Yeah. That's a good point. But there was that whole wave in there. And I feel like
We haven't really... a while, because in the early 2000s, we were still getting stuff like
Day After Tomorrow.
Day After Tomorrow, The Core, stuff like that.
We owe the Day After Tomorrow an apology, I feel. I remember when the Day After Tomorrow was this Roland Emmerich movie. Roland Emmerich, of course, did Independence Day and Stargate, and it was a big hit machine for a while, and still occasionally makes a good movie. But he made this futuristic, like semi-science fiction disaster movie where every one of our worst-case projections for climate change was like, and it's like, oh, that's the California will be inhospitable in like 200 years. Yeah. No, we actually meant 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, the timeline got pushed up, and I remember at the time, everyone's like, this is so stupid. There's no way climate change could affect the world this fast. 20 years later, I apologize, Day After Tomorrow. You were right, and I was wrong.
Yeah, well, and until Jake Gyllenhaal is running away from cold.
Hey, I buy Jake Gyllenhaal running away from cold more than I buy Elijah Wood and Lily Sobieski on a kid's dirt bike outrunning a tsunami that they have explicitly said is going at the speed of sound. Because that's in deep impact.
That's a really fast dirt bike.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty good movie. It's actually like, if you rewatch him, it's actually kind of a better movie than Armageddon, but that's a stupid sequence right there.
Well,
I didn't buy that at all.
I never saw Armageddon, and I hope never to.
But in any case,
it is the opposite of my jam.
What's kind of fascinating about these like big disaster movies, because big disaster movies were this gigantic box office phenomenon in the 70s, and then they mostly went away in the 80s, and then when CGI started making more things possible, they got like a new lease on life in the 90s and kind of the 2000s, and they petered out a little bit. We'll still get the occasional one. The CGI made it possible to do them cheaply and crappily. And now there's a ton of disaster movies that have gone straight to video or straight to the Sci-Fi Channel. It turns out they're pretty easy to do. All you really need is some sort of command center and then some people in a car. And then some exteriors you can CG a disaster onto, and then like a wind machine maybe, and like debris, and then like rescuing people from underneath rubble. It's actually pretty easy to do almost any disaster with After Effects now.
That's what the Sci-Fi Channel was doing for a long, long time. In fact, a lot of their really corny monster movies take that same structure.
Yeah.
It's like, but the monster is, you know, a five-headed shark attack or whatever they got.
Yeah. Some of them are fun, most of them are white.
Yeah, I remember you assigned me one to review a long time ago, when we were both at Crave.
Which one was it?
It was called Metal Tornado.
Oh, God.
Which sounds...
I forgot about Metal Tornado. Metal that with Lou Diamond Phillips?
Lou Diamond Phillips is in that one. God. And Metal Tornado sounds like a really awesome like album title, but it's like Anvil put out Metal Tornado. No, Metal Tornado was about... essentially like free-floating magnetic fields that were spinning and would pick up metal objects and essentially make gigantic metal buzzsaw tornado things.
Look, I think that was post-Sharknado, if memory serves.
Yes, it was post-Sharknado.
After Sharknado,
about the same.
Around that time, people were just like, tornado's kind of boring. What can we add to a tornado? What can we add to a volcano? And then it started getting kind of weird. Like, there's one that was like, there's one out there somewhere that's like airplane versus volcano. And I'm like,
my money's on the volcano.
Money's on the airplane. It's got the maneuverability. You can just try to fly around that fucker.
If they're fighting and the airplane's like flying into a volcano saying, I'm going to get you.
The airplane has mastered the art of fighting without fighting. So the volcano is going to burn itself out trying to hit the tornado. And then the volcano is just going to be so tired. It's just like, I give up. And then the plane wins.
How does it beat a volcano?
It lets the volcano beat itself.
Oh, I see. And it just flies away?
Yeah, it's like
it doesn't do any actual damage to the volcano.
It's like Homer Simpson when he was a boxer, he let people just beat him up until like they were just like got like so tired he just knock him over. Yeah. That's it.
We're not talking about Christmas Twister a lot because there's not a lot to talk about.
Here's the thing with Christmas
Casper
Twister.
Casper Van Dien has a family. Haley Lou Richardson is his teenage daughter. He has a young son. It's, from what I understand, it's Christmas Eve, but they still have to go to school?
Yeah, that's
a little weird. It's Christmas Eve. They still have to go to school. Haley Lou Richardson skips school so she can go to the mall with her best friend and meet a boy she has a crush on and do some Christmas shopping. boy ends up, the young boy ends up spilling the beans on her, later in the movie.
You skipped a bit. So basically Casper Van Dien goes to work and he believes that because of climate change, all of their predictions about tornado season this year are way off and serious tornadoes are going to be, coming along like right now. And we need to let the world know. Fortunately, his wife is an anchorwoman at a local television station. And he calls her up and says, hey, listen, the weatherman at your TV station sucks. And there's actually potentially going to be, there's already had one serious tornado. There's probably going to be more. You should at least tell people to be on alert. And she says, no, because there was that one time in Chicago when you said there was going to be a bunch of tornadoes and then there weren't any. And then we looked like idiots. So we're just not going to tell people to be safe. And Richard Berge is the kind of like meteorologist who's A, only interested in ratings. He wants to like leave town and like take Casper Van Dien's wife with him. And, you know, get a gig at, like, a big network. But he's also the kind of guy who's like, there's no such thing as climate change. You know, it's been hot before. So that means there's no such thing as climate change, and we don't have to worry about this at all. And at no point today shall my uppance come. No, certainly not. Certainly not later in the film will I insist on getting, like, a really good shot of a tornado on the roof of a power plant, and then a giant cargo container will fly towards me very slowly, and instead of ducking like a person would do, I'm just going to hold my hands in the air and go, ah, I guess I deserve this, and then I'll die. That will certainly not happen. Spoiler alert, it does. So Casper Van Dien has to try to rescue his family. His son is at school. He takes his son out of school. There's a fun bit later on when they're in the they're in their car and they hear a thing on the news about how a tornado hit his son's school. And at first you think, oh my God, it's a good thing he got his son out. His son's probably the only survivor. And then they say literally every other child survived. And then I'm like, oh, so you really didn't need to waste your time with that kid, did you? That kid would have been fine.
Well, also, it's out of season, but this is Tornado Alley. They say that they have tornadoes.
Yeah.
So they're prepared for them. Presumably, public buildings like a public school
have shelters.
Would have a shelter underneath.
And indeed, that's a plot point. They had a shelter at that school. They had, at the mall where the daughter is, they're not expecting a tornado. So initially, it starts ripping things apart, and they're like, oh, God. But then they all go to the storm shelter, and everyone who went to the storm shelter is fine. So, it's very pro storm shelter, this movie. This movie brought to you by storm shelters. Storm shelter brand storm shelter.
The problem is tornadoes are hitting a place that is well prepared for tornadoes. It's not a really good drama.
No.
Oh, they're a few months ahead of schedule is like the one scare.
Well, see, here's the thing. In a nutshell, Casper Van Dien is trying to reunite his family. His family is trying to protect people from various tornadoes. Like, two people die. But everything else is more or less fine. A whole bunch of stuff breaks, and there's a big F6 at the end. Holy shit, but everything's fine. It's very much a tornado movie, the movie. It's just the absolute baseline tornado movie. You would normally, like, it's like when, like, you get, like, the 99-cent bag of pasta from your local supermarket, and then you get, like, whatever the generic store brand, like, tomato sauce is, and, like, that's all you do, and it takes you, like, then all of a sudden you realize, wait a minute, I could add stuff to the sauce, like, I could put some, like, actual, like, mushrooms in this, or something, and actually, like, make it, like, give it, like, some personality and flavor, and I could, you know, this is just the baseline tornado movie. What's frustrating is that the basic premise of the movie is that tornado season is early, and in fact, it's so early that it's Christmas. They do fuck all with that premise. Yeah, like, they mention that it's Christmas like three times, and that's it.
I was describing the premise of this to my long-suffering wife, who has to hear about these movies I'm watching. And I said, I'm watching Christmas Twister. It has Casper Van Dien. She's like, fine, I'll be in the other room. She'll take a bullet for me, but not that many.
Yeah, that's too high a caliber.
Yeah,
like that is a hollow point.
She's watched some bad movies with me, but she won't sit down and watch it if she doesn't have to. And so she started giving me premises just off the top of her head. I said, it's Christmas Twister. It's about a Twister Christmas. She's like, okay, so Santa is real and he's been blown out of the sky. And now we have to like protect Santa from a Twister. And Santa has to like fly around and use Santa powers to stop the Twister.
Better idea than what we got. That's a good movie. Yeah.
Or if you're going to have a Christmas Twister, it hits New York.
Yeah.
During like the tree lighting ceremony at Rockefeller Center. And it, like, it sucks the tree up into the air. You have iconography like that, where Christmas things are being destroyed.
And at the end of the movie, the tree has landed on top of the Empire State Building, like, perfectly, standing up, and it's gorgeous.
No, it's landed in Kansas.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been blown really far away.
All right, fine.
It just sails through the stratosphere.
Well, there's so many, even if you don't want to go, like, with that, like, high concept with it, I mean, the fact that it's at Christmas time means that there's probably a lot of public gatherings. That would be more difficult to evacuate, and people aren't necessarily near shelters. Now, granted, this is a low-budget movie, and they don't have a lot of crowds, but you could at least talk about that. I think the thing that offends me more is that there aren't more Christmas gags. Now, I don't mean specifically jokes.
Mm.
When we say gag in movies, what we often mean is a little bit. You know, like we've come up with... like, there's a bit in Jason X, for example, where Jason throws someone off a rafter, and then they land on a gigantic drill. And they're impaled by the drill, and that's horrifying. But then, because it's a drill bit, they start, like, rotating downward. That's a gag. That's, we've killed somebody, but we added something sort of interesting and noteworthy about it to make this incident more memorable and more entertaining. That can be, you can do that with jokes, you can do that with horror, you can do that with action, but basically you're just taking the baseline version of a thing and ladling some personality onto it. Christmas gives you a lot of opportunities here. You could have Christmas lights flying up in the air. You could have, the local town has, like, a life-size Santa and reindeer, like, thing in the street or whatever. Like, oh, look at our... Every year we put up this Santa and these styrofoam reindeer, and it's great. And then the styrofoam reindeer are flying around in the tornado.
There's
some kid that looks out the window like, wow, holy shit!
And it sucks up the mall Santa, and he's like, oh, no, help me!
And it looks like so magical because Santa's out. Like, there are gags you can do with this.
There's one Christmas sort of thing they do... Casper Van Dien's family has like a nativity scene, like a creche out in their front yard. And it's the only thing that's not ruined.
Makes you think, doesn't it?
No. I want to see that get sucked into a tornado. That proves that the tornado... The religious aspect
of... It was a religious tornado.
Okay,
it was a religious tornado.
Christian tornado. Call it Christian tornado.
There's so many, you know, we've talked about this before. We've talked about this many, many, many times. When you're studying movies, when you're starting to get interested in cinema, beyond the casual, oh, let's go see a movie this weekend. But like, no, I'm really excited and I've learned about all these new filmmakers, these new eras of film, and I want to really study movies because I find that exciting and it makes the whole art form just blossom. The initial wave of that is almost universally, you start watching the classics. You hear about Citizen Kane, you hear about Alfred Hitchcock, you hear about Ingmar Bergman, you hear about whatever. You hear about all of these classic movies that you need to catch up on. And then you do. And you start seeing some of the best movies ever made, and it's really incredible. And that's one of the best things about being a film lover is that sense of discovery. When you discover something important, and then you realize that maybe this really wonderful older movie has influenced all these other movies that you've seen that you didn't even know about that influence yet, and all of a sudden, everything feels interconnected, and it's gorgeous. But there comes a time where you hit kind of critical mass on that, and you've watched so many absolutely brilliant movies by filmmakers with distinctive voices and things to say, and an absolute mastery of the technical craft, and you've just seen so many movies that are 4 stars that after a while, it doesn't actually help you creatively necessarily because those movies arguably are hard to improve upon.
Yeah.
So if you there's a risk if you're studying something like Citizen Kane, you're not going to necessarily figure out how to make your own movie. You're just going to figure out how they made Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
once you have a baseline, once you know a lot about the history of cinema and great art and how movies are made and the terminology and basically how all that sausage gets produced. Mm. I think one of the best and most important things you can do is start watching crap. Like just like real crap.
Really bad stuff.
Schlock, cult movies, not all of them are crap, but many of them are, you know, they're popular in spite of themselves because there's a certain amount of ineptitude or cheapness involved. And or maybe there's a really good idea, but they never really missed the mark or they didn't have the ability to get away with whatever they were trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. When you watch a movie that has distinct flaws, and you know enough about movies to know, to have some idea of how you might fix those flaws, when you're watching a movie like Christmas Twister, it can actually be really exciting because you think to yourself, okay,
well,
they give me this movie, how would I fix this?
Yeah,
and then you can get really creative and then you can actually like, I think that's a really exciting part of the process of learning about movies is watching movies that aren't great and trying to think about them in a way that is exciting in and of itself.
Yeah. Think of it like a creative challenge. I watched a documentary recently called Chaos on the Bridge. It's about the making of Star Trek: The Next Generation. It's in preparation of our Star Trek podcast. And Gene Roddenberry, rather infamously, in the writer's room, had a mandate saying you can't have interpersonal conflict on Next Generation. That's my new mandate. That's a rule of the show. You can't have people just bickering amongst themselves. That's not okay.
Doesn't matter that that's what the original series did constantly. That's the whole point of Bones. Is the
character. I want this to be a definitely a better future. That's my idea for Next Generation. Yeah. And all of the writers said, "What? Why? How are we going to have drama if we don't have people bickering all the time?" And Gene Roddenberry just said, "Figure it out," and he left the room.
Yeah.
One of the writers on that show, Brennan Braga, is on record saying he actually appreciated that kind of stricture because it forced him to think more creatively.
Yeah, you can't fall back on old patterns, tropes, ideas, you know, like, oh, I'll have a character like this, and, you know, he doesn't like this character because their personalities clash. Like, no, what if they like each other and are supportive of each other?
Yeah, and they work together well, and they come at problems from different angles, and they have to reconcile each other's point of views. That kind of stuff.
And it took him a while to crack that code.
Yeah, it really started to sing. I hate it when people say stuff like this, but like it gets better in later seasons. The first two seasons have a lot of promise, and it's an interesting show. Watch those first two seasons. It's better in later seasons, that's all. So when you're a filmmaker, and let's say you're fresh out of film school, and your first like for-hire job is directing Christmas Twister, or writing Christmas Twister.
Yeah.
Now, Christmas Twister clearly came out of a factory.
Oh, yeah.
These are people who know the tropes, and they're just repeating it. They're writing these over a weekend.
We have a budget. We have a timeline. Yeah. The movie needs to be delivered by this date.
And there's definitely a talent, or at least an admirable skill, in being able to make a film on a very low budget over the course of a couple days.
And it's worth noting that this is not so low budget that it all takes place in, like, a bunker or something. This actually is, like, wrangling, like, a lot of different locations. They're not particularly exciting locations, but there's a lot of locations.
A lot of basement locations.
There is a mall. They actually are filming in an actual mall. They're filming in like at a school. They're filming a lot of exteriors in different places. And again, they're all pretty close together geographically, but it wasn't like we can shoot 20 pages a day kind of thing. This was a bit of a logistical accomplishment.
And there's a lot to be said for that sort of thing. That is a talent unto itself, is being able to wrangle all of those things and just get it done.
Yeah.
So understand that if you are a young filmmaker trying to make your way in the business, that you're going to have an assignment like this. And if you take a really healthy sort of worker's approach to it, I need to do it this fast in this way. And if you're creative enough, maybe you can do something interesting with that. I'm going to put this kind of character in it. I'm going to have this conflict in it that's not really cliched. And of course, your cast comes sort of prepackaged. It's like, we're going to make this. Casper Van Dien's the lead. Start writing. It's like, I don't have a script, but we have a lead actor already. Okay, we'll write a part for Casper Van Dien.
Yeah.
It's not like they wrote the script and then searched high and low for a year and a half for Casper Van Dien. We need just the right people for these roles.
Right.
As those kinds of films go, this one's totally average. I'm not a huge fan of these kinds of movies. I worked for Roger Corman for 2 years. I saw a lot of these things in production. I've seen the sausage get made. There's no romance to it. They're just clearly churning these things out really, really quick. Not a lot of thought goes into them. You're not going to get a lot of thought out of them. Mm. If they are kind of entertaining, it's always completely by accident. Mm-hmm. And occasionally you'll have a director who has like a little bit of a quirky sense of humor, mm-hmm. or is like has a recognizable style. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean they're necessarily good, but at least they're kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that way about Jim Wynorski, who is...
Yeah, to say what you will, he's got a style.
He's you recognize a Jim Wynorski movie. Yeah.
He's a weird, sleazy guy.
I was trying to steer away from the word sleazy, but that's a good word to describe Jim Wynorski.
He makes sleaze.
He did movies with titles like The Bear Wench Project.
Yeah.
So this one doesn't have like a kind of quirk to it. It doesn't have a particular sense of humor. I think Casper Van Dien is doing a job. I think Haley Lou Richardson has some personality. You can look at her and say she's going to do something better. Like I remember when we saw that that failed pilot for The Partridge Family, and a young Emma Stone was in that. Emily Stone, she was credited as. And mm-hmm. you get to see her in that, and she actually has a lot of life and energy and a good sense of humor, and you realize, oh, she could be a big movie star. And
yeah,
now
she's got promise.
Now she has
yeah.
an Academy Award. She actually fulfilled that promise. And I feel the same way about watching a Haley Lou Richardson in something like Christmas Twister.
Yeah.
It's like she's bringing some humanity to this role that demands nothing of her.
She's quite good. And to be fair, she's not the only one. Casper Van Dien does what he has to do here.
Yeah.
You know, it's a thankless role, but he does it. You know, he came to work. And he did. Good for him. There's a lot of supporting cast. Can't really say that. But you know what? There's no sense in punching down. They're here to do a job, damn it.
One of the actresses... who's like the ultra Texan rival in the TV studio?
Oh, it was the producer.
Oh,
I forget the character's name. Hold on. Let me see if I can figure it out.
There's a producer of the news programs that that Richard Berge writes for, or as
The actor's name is Christina DeRosa.
Okay.
Christina DeRosa, who apparently had a role in the movie Bad Moms.
Oh, I saw Bad Moms.
Let's see what else was she in that you might have heard of or seen. She was on a TV show called Mood Swings. She was in Jane the Virgin for a few episodes. She's been in a lot of things, but it's mostly like little roles and stuff. Yeah, she was in Evil Bong 3, The Wrath of Bong.
Do you know there are 7 of those movies? 7
yes,
Evil
I
Bong
did
movies.
Actually know that.
Okay, so... She is the only person trying to sound like they're in Texas at all.
Oh yeah, and she's trying to compensate for everybody.
Yeah, so she is putting on like this really broad Foghorn Leghorn style like deep Southern accent.
Yeah.
Another note for my wife. My wife comes from Louisiana, so she likes to point out how wrong Southern accents are in movies a lot.
And
movies and on TV.
People because don't realize there are actually differences between
regions. Yeah, there's like
regions.
There's a difference between a Tennessee accent and a Louisiana accent. And so she likes to sort of point out or just scoff at the fact that the accents are usually pretty wrong.
Yeah. We also need to mention just another experienced and talented actor who has a very small role here. But got to give a lot of credit to Stephen Williams.
Yeah, Mr. X.
I know him
as Mr. X from The X-Files.
Yeah, Stephen Williams, you might know as Mr. X from The X-Files. He was Creighton Duke in Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday. He was also, perhaps most notably, Blackjack Savage.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Williams, Blackjack Savage is a character from the TV series The 100 Lives of Blackjack Savage, which, if you're unfamiliar with our podcast, Cancel Too Soon, where we covered it quite a few years ago, it's a story about a protagonist based explicitly on Donald Trump who runs. He's a hotel magnate who flees the country for tax evasion, buys a haunted mansion in the Caribbean from a wacky fascist dictator, and it turns out the mansion is haunted by the ghost of an abolitionist pirate, played by Stephen Williams, who is going to hell because he killed 100 people, and if he doesn't save 100 lives
himself by saving 100
lives.
He needs to
team up with Donald Trump to save 100 lives using a sci-fi superboat.
Night boat, essentially.
Yeah, that's a real thing. And that's that Disney made that. And they lasted multiple episodes. And now Stephen Williams is here. And
he's Mr. X.
He's Mr. X. He's cool. He's actually a really good actor. I like Stephen Williams a lot. But Anyway, that's that. Anyway, I think we've kind of covered Christmas Twister. Can we say that?
Yeah, there's unfortunately not much. There's a lot of scenes of people hiding in basements.
Yeah.
And again, I'm watching Christmas Twister. I want to see more Twister, or at least want to see destruction. There was a glory shot of, I think there must have been like some sort of demolition recently. Because I think it was documentary footage of some small town that had been wrecked. So there was like a bunch of smoldering pits of like recently destroyed buildings.
Yeah.
That didn't look like special effects. I think they actually bothered to shoot something.
Yeah.
But there's a lot long span where there's no Twister and we're just sort of like recovering and, you know, talking about the destruction and it becomes really kind of dour and sad. And it's about survival and destroying the destruction of the small town. I tuned in to see a Christmas Twister.
Yeah.
I wanted to have candy cane stripes. You know, I want something a little fun and silly and you know, Christmassy. Something that make, you know, justifies this goofy title. Yeah, no, they just made a straight disaster movie, and that's so less exciting.
And again, the interesting thing is right in your premise. Mm-hmm. And I suspect they probably started with this whole F6 thing, and they were like, okay, so tornado season comes early, blah. But then at some point, someone realized, it's a Twister movie at Christmas. That's the selling point, but I feel like probably by that point the movie had been made and it was too late to actually make the most of it. And I feel like maybe they shot that opening separately in order to do that. Maybe not. I don't know. It's hard to say. That's all just a guessing game. But I wish I could have been there early on in the process and just say, lean into the Christmas thing more. Like, make it Christmassy. Like, seriously.
There needs to be some jerk producer with a cigar who strolls onto set on the third day of shooting and say, not Christmassy enough. Put more Christmas there.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, that would make it stupid. I know! That's what this movie needs!
Yeah. And the director's gonna fight it, and then, like, you cut to, like, 3 days later, and they're shooting this weird bit with Santa and the reindeer flying up in the air, and the director is like, God damn it, he was right.
Yeah. I think you and I reviewed one of the Sharktopus movies, or several of the Sharktopus movies.
We did all three of the Sharktopus
movies. That's right, we did all three of the Sharktopus movies. And
I think there's only three.
Well, I think the first one was just a straight up creature feature. It's like, oh no, it's a Sharktopus. Okay, what are we gonna do from our like military base where a bunch of people are sitting around the, you know, glowing screens? Oh no, it's entering the ocean, sir. And they're just talking about, oh no, this thing. It's a shark, but it has tentacles. Okay, you have a monster, and you're just gonna get it.
Yeah.
Like, what are you gonna do with a Sharktopus? And the other ones, they try to make it a little bit more comedic. To very bad effect, but at least they're trying to make comedies.
Well, I think the third one is when they started actually having like a super villain who was like trying to turn people into a Sharktopus, and there was voodoo in it, and that one made it more like a comic book, which I feel like was probably the better way to go. The third one's actually pretty good. Actually.
I think it's the third one that has Conan O'Brien in it.
I think it's the first one that has Conan O'Brien in it.
It was the first one?
Conan O'Brien has a bit in it where he's just, or maybe it was Sharktopus 2, but like, where it's just him being an asshole on a beach and then he's killed by a Sharktopus.
Yeah.
Good for Conan.
That's Conan's shtick, is that he's like kind of this brusque jerk. And you know, he's funny and self-effacing. No, he's not. He's actually like abuses the people around him. So that he just sort of plays that up and
gets killed by a Sharktopus.
He gets killed. His like a tentacle like goes up his butt and rips his head off. And then they play volleyball with his head. And I'm sure he was very happy to...
Oh my god, I would kill for a scene like that. That would be my legacy. I'd be like, hey, listen, I realize that almost nothing in my life went right, but there was that one time I was killed by a Sharktopus.
That was John Waters thinking when he was in Seed of Chucky.
Yeah, he just wanted to be killed in a horror movie.
I
want to
be killed by a horror movie slasher. I want to be killed by Chucky.
Yeah.
And they pour acid on his face.
Oh my god, I would kill to be... I had recurring nightmares about Chucky. It would seem so poetic if I actually got to be killed by Chucky. Mm-hmm. Like, how great would that be? You know, there's a Chucky TV series coming out from the original creator, Don Mancini.
It's out, isn't it?
I don't think it started yet. I saw the trailer though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
There's a new TV series. There's also that new movie.
Yeah.
I think they're making another movie in the original continuity or something.
There's like two versions of Chucky that got bifurcated. Mm-hmm. Like MGM owns the rights to this much of the concept, but the actual ongoing series is its own separate thing. So they're allowed to make that. That Mark Hamill remake is actually not bad, but but like they're allowed to do that version, but the other one's allowed to keep going concurrently, and it just gets confusing and weird.
Conan O'Brien was in Sharktopus versus Terracuda.
Okay, so that was the second one.
which was the second one. The third one was Sharktopus versus Whale Wolf.
Whale Wolf was kind of fun.
It was
the one I liked the best.
I suppose so.
Yeah. None of them are good. Mm. But Whale Wolf was, at the very least, like, it knew what it was doing. Mm. Yeah, I thought I had a good time. Anyway, that's Christmas Twister. Thanks, patrons. Thanks,
yeah. I could have been watching Bridesmaids.
I hope our patrons thought this was a fun conversation. I really do, because I was worried watching this movie. I'm like, is this even going to be a fun episode? Yeah, like, it's really just kind of a generic and weird movie.
Something to talk about here.
Yeah, so we filled the time. No one can say we didn't. It was almost an hour here. I interviewed Craig Ferguson once. Mm. It was for the movie Brave. And I was very nervous, actually, because I'd never interviewed someone who interviewed people for a living. He had that talk show, and it was very popular.
The Late Late Show.
Yeah, again, he hasn't been on for a while. I think it was replaced by Seth Meyers.
No, he was replaced by James Corden.
Oh. That's a shift.
Well, I think he expected to get The Late Show, but they didn't even offer him. And so I think he's like, oh, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. Yeah. I'm going to do a podcast or other things. Now he's hosting a show called The Hustler, which is a game show.
Cool. Well, anyway, Craig Ferguson's a comic genius, and he was very nice, man. And I interviewed him because he was one of the voices in Brave, and I asked him, it's like, hey, listen, I've had to interview quite a few people, but I've never interviewed anyone who interviewed people before. What's the secret? You do a talk show. What's the secret to interviewing people? And he said, get to the commercial.
Keep talking.
And then at the end, you cut to a commercial. If you get to the commercial, you win.
It doesn't matter if it's good or bad. Yeah. You filled the time.
Yeah, that's kind of it. Like, people just want to hear people talk. And then at the end, they're done talking. Mm. And then the commercial lets you know you've done your job. And I kind of appreciated how mercenary it was. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. I know there's a lot more to it than that.
For Craig Ferguson, that's all he needed.
Again, you need to just keep it going. You can't get so wrapped up in it and trying to make everything perfect. You just have to, like, keep the conversation going. And that's enough. We try to do more than that. But at some point, we just can't make podcasts. I hope you liked this one. I think we made the most of it. Next time on the Critically Acclaimed Streaming Club, we are headed over to Shudder. Shudder is a streaming service dedicated almost exclusively to horror movies. Anything else they have is usually, like, at least tangentially horror. They have a lot of great selections of new, old, and cult films for the horror enthusiast. Whitney and I are both horror enthusiasts. However, in searching their data banks, We were all able to find at least a couple of interesting movies that we have never actually seen. And in no particular order, here are the options for next week. Spookies! Spookies is a cult horror film from the mid-80s about a bunch of people who are lured into, I think it's like a castle, and then they're like attacked by a bunch of different wild, crazy monsters? Something?
Yeah, there's a bunch of wild, crazy monsters around.
Okay, cool.
It was like shot in shifts by like with different ideas and different scripts, so nice. It doesn't really cohere in any kind of meaningful way.
All right, next up is an Australian film called Turkey Shoot. Tell people about Turkey Shoot. I don't really know much about it.
It's a people being hunted in the woods kind of movie.
Cool.
And it's one of the more popular Ozploitation flicks. There's a really wonderful documentary film out there called Not Quite Hollywood, which is about the rise and boom of Australian exploitation movies in specifically the 70s, but before and after. And because of like censorship laws and things, filmmakers had a lot more leeway to do a lot more lurid material. And something about shooting in Australia made some of the most exciting exploitation movies out there. There were a lot of excellent car movies, a lot of weird monster movies, a lot of interesting photography, and a lot of genre filmmakers getting their start during that time.
Yeah. We also have the other two options are both coincidentally Mario Bava films.
Mm.
First up, we have A Bay of Blood, which is about a wealthy lady who gets killed, and then a whole bunch of people are like scrambling over her inheritance, and they all start getting brutally murdered on an island. This is a movie from the early 1970s that ended up having like a huge influence on the American slasher genre, and also in the giallo genre in general. It's considered a big classic. And then also from Mario Bava, there's a supernatural film called Shock, which is about a couple being terrorized by an evil ghost, and they possess the kid's son. And
that's made by Mario Bava.
That's all I know about that one. Mario Bava, if you don't know Mario Bava is one of the most stylish filmmakers who ever lived. I think it's no exaggeration whatsoever.
is born in Spain, but made a lot of movies in Italy. Mm-hmm. I think born in Spain.
I don't know about that.
Remembering that correctly, and
I'll see if I can find that out before we run out of time.
Mario Bava, yeah, is in the same camp as Lucio Fulci and
Dario Argento.
Oh, he's born in Italy.
He's born in Italy.
I don't know what I'm talking about then. But yeah, he's one of like the premier Italian schlockmeisters. And you're incredibly prolific. Made a lot of really bad movies, but a lot of really notable ones as well.
Yeah, he made some of the best horror movies ever made. He also made stuff like superhero movies and Hercules movies and Viking films, and astoundingly prolific. But somehow, in the middle of all of that, he managed to inject a spectacular amount of style and panache into pretty much all of his movies. I've seen bad Mario Bava movies, but I've never seen bad looking Mario Bava movies.
That's fair. That's a fair observation.
But I've also seen absolutely brilliant Mario Bava movies. I think he is one of the, at least in the mainstream, one of the like least appreciated geniuses. So we have two here. I'm sure they'd both be exciting. I'm not going to say which one or both were mine, but I actually haven't seen either of those. In fact, I'm actually just going to say it. I haven't seen anything that that is up for next time.
Yeah.
So
I've seen one of them a long time ago.
Okay. Fair enough. So it's all going to be new to us, and you can vote on Patreon. Once again, that's patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Every single patron gets to vote for episodes of Critically Acclaimed, even if it's just $1 a month. Mm-hmm. Also, for $1 a month, you get our Batman podcast, Holy Batman, where Whitney and I are working our way through every single episode of the 1960s Batman TV series, which is quite a hoot.
And we're coming down on the end of the second season, which took a long time.
That's a lot of episodes. It's a long season. But it's really exciting. They got wonderful, great guest stars, and it's a very funny show. So we're doing that. We also have our Star Trek podcast, All Our Yesterdays, is on Patreon. That's at a higher tier, but we're about to start our journey through every single episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. The first episode of All Our Yesterdays that covers the pilot of Next Generation will be available for free here on the main feed, just to give people a taste. But after that, they're all up on Patreon. And we also have shows about the Oscars, commentary tracks, hangouts every month. We try to make it worth your while. So thank you to everybody who can contribute. If you can't afford to contribute, we totally get it. But if you could leave us a review wherever you find us, that would really help us out a lot. Star rating, a sentence really helps. Just any sort of written down thing just tells people that someone gives a crap. We're also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I am at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold.
And if you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode or anything at all, really, you can email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we might read your email in an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. Whitney, tell them about our post office box.
We have a P.O. box. You can mail us like a real letter if you want to. Put a stamp on it. Put it in the mailbox.
Some coins to the front and just hope they accept that as legal.
Yeah, tender. Look around your neighborhood. You'll find these little robots waiting on the corner. These little blue ones with four legs.
And they eat your mail.
Yeah, you put the mail in their mouth and go, yum, 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 yum. But they can't move yet because their feet are bolted down. But the mail workers come down and they unbolt their feet at the end of the night. And
they
it'll
run away.
And it'll scurry that letter toward us. That little robot will deliver it to us. So be sure to feed the robot. But be sure to write down the right address. It's Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
And also, don't forget, we have soap. We sell soap, me and M. Lopez da Silva, via our soap store, Saltcat Soap. Saltcat Soap, all one word, is on Twitter and Instagram if you want to follow along. But if you go to Etsy.com and look for Saltcat Soap, again, all one word, you're going to find a lot of designer soaps. They're really, really gorgeous. They're handcrafted. They have a lot of different distinct aromas. We got traditional soaps. We have fancy soaps you can use as nice gifts or just to treat yourself. We have shave bars. Thank you. It's late. My brain started to die.
Shave bars, shampoo bars,
lotions, bath salts, a lot over there. And thank you, everybody, who's already tried out the store. The reviews have been really excellent so far, and that means a lot to us. Thank you again. So, we'll be back next week with whatever our patrons pick from Shudder. And until then, never forget... I forgot.
How about you say, thank you for joining the club?
Thank you for joining us.